You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Hello, folks. Welcome. For you don't know, do not know me, my name is Tim Lorden. I'm the Executive Director of the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, and I'm going to moderate today. There's probably like half the audience has way more knowledge on this topic than I do, so if I say something wrong or inappropriate, it's just out of sheer ignorance, not out of ill will. So I'm going to make that caveat. I have a great panel today to talk about our next session. We have a variety of great folks from a variety of different perspectives. We want to have a good conversation. We'll open it up to Q&A, and we'll have a variety of different perspectives. I welcome comments and questions from the audience. This is a pretty wide-ranging discussion on this particular topic. And let me just start by saying we did something similar to this about in 2005 at the State of the Net Conference. It might have been the second State of the Net that we had. And the title of that panel was, Did the Internet Kill the Telecom Act? And when the moderator started going down to the panelists, everybody routinely expressed their disgust at such a horrible title and why it was so poorly framed. And I'm just going to admit right off the bat that I hate the title of this one, which is, Should Congress Rewrite the Telecom Act? And I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed by the title, but it has certain... People have certain associations, people know what we're talking about. It kind of puts us in a milieu of congressional action or not. And we thought it would be good shorthand for a larger conversation about where do we go from this. Back in 2005, some of the panelists said, well, that's a stupid title. It should have been, Is the Telecom Act Killing the Internet? That was another change to it. Some people said, Is the Telecom Act even relevant? And things like that. So... That said, I'm admitting that it's a terrible title, but we wanted to go through a variety of different things about the question about what's the appropriate regulatory structure for what we, in common parlance, say is the internet, right? When I say in the panel description that this goes back a long time, I mean you can go back further than the anecdote that I'm going to suggest, but you can even go back to Al Gore when he was vice president. Please know Al Gore jokes about the internet. I know Larry was very teed up to say one there. And Al Gore back in when he was vice president suggested for this information superhighway, some kind of like, we see this broadband stuff coming, this internet stuff coming. Why don't we just create a new title of the Communications Act of 1934? And he said, we'll create a Title VII, and we'll throw, you know, all the things that are broadband or internet or whatever you want to call it, IP, information superhighway, if you like that term, which he did, we'll throw it all into Title VII. And that'll be regulated, a light-touch approach, probably something similar to what ended up being, you know, for wireless services or something like that. And the thing is, we're not going to force everybody to go there. It'd be voluntary. So people could elect to go into Title VII. And they could say, you know what, I don't like being, you know, Title II. I don't like being Title I. I don't like being a common carrier. I don't like being cable. I don't like any of this stuff. But I'd rather take my chances in Title VII. And when I voluntarily go in there, and by the way, Professor Yu is here. He's going to correct me if I'm wrong, which I probably am. You have to kind of take on certain, you know, certain minimal obligations. And depending on how you looked at it, they might have been minimal. They might have been maximal. But at that period of time, I think they were trying to, you know, say that they were minimal. And the idea, you know, the idea was that people would voluntarily go into it. They'd have predictability with regard to the regulatory structure. And they'd take on certain obligations that they knew what they were going to get, and we'd be done with it. Over time, obviously, it didn't work out that way. Back, you know, maybe as early as 1989, certainly 1992 and 1994, Congress started working on the Telecom Act. Which ultimately was passed in 1996, which mentioned the internet in only one place, I should remind everybody, and that was in the Communications Decency Act, which applied the broadcast indecency standard to the World Wide Web. So porn was the only really mention of the internet in the Telecom Act of 1996.
And that was declared unconstitutional.
Which was struck down 16 years ago, almost to the day, in ACLU versus Reno. So... And mercifully, the other section of the Communications Decency Act survived, the kind of limited liability. But that's a story for another day. I'd like to kind of the panelists to kind of talk about, you know, start us off by telling us how you know dismayed they are with the title of the panel, but also kind of what would we try to accomplish with the Telecom Act? The Telecom Act of 96 had a variety of different purposes, not the least of which was porn eradication. But the relevant thing was trying to get providers in local and long distance to compete with one another, try to promote kind of more of a level playing field and like this 16-point or 12-point checklist on how you could get into long distance or long distance into local, things like that. Trying to level the playing field, try to get larger companies to compete against each other. And remember, the Bell system was very different back then. You had local providers, you had long-distance providers, and you had pockets of different bells. It was a very, very different setup than we have now. So let me just kind of go through our panelists. I'll introduce them all at once. To my right, we have Professor Christopher Yu from University of Pennsylvania. Christopher has been on half a dozen panels that we've moderated, whether it be net neutrality or some of these kind of broadband issues, and we're very happy to have Professor Yu. Next to him is Corey Wright, who is from Netflix. Corey is formerly from Free Press, so we're happy to have Corey. And next to her is Kathy Sloan from the Communications, the Computer and Communications Industry Association. And Kathy has been working on these issues for a long time on telecom and before that. And down at the end of the table in cleanup, so to speak, is Larry Downs, who is an author and commentator. He's written more books than I've even read, so we're very happy to have Larry with us. But
you haven't read more than three books?
It's been tough. I got three books on my Kindle. I haven't gotten through all of them, one of which is Susan Crawford's recent book on the title of which is
Captive Audience,
and I'm only halfway through it, so I apologize. I tried to saw through it this weekend. I couldn't get to it. Christopher.
Okay. Delighted to be back at the Congressional Internet Caucus and the State of the Net Conference. I don't hate the title. I actually think that it tees up a very interesting set of issues, and it brings up a wonderful conundrum, which is, rewriting the Telecom Act would be terrible except for the alternative, which is not rewriting it. So what do I mean by that? Not rewriting it. We have a statute that was written, the bulk of it was written in 1934, the cable stuff written in 1984, without the technology of the internet in mind. And without a new statutory authorization, the way that the statute will actually apply to the internet will be largely an accident. We'll take words written for a different context that no one really had the internet in mind and force them on it. And we'll discover that, in fact, it's a very bad fit. It's a bad fit both in terms of the substance, but it's also, we're discovering through the ongoing litigation over the open internet order, it's not entirely clear it's a good fit in terms of jurisdiction. And so what I think of is the last time we had a big fight over ancillary jurisdiction, which was the cable industry, which developed in the early 1950s, and we had a series of Supreme Court cases beating up and down about whether it was within the ancillary jurisdiction of the FCC. Until finally, some 30 years later, the Congress steps in and clearly gives the federal government jurisdiction and allocates the authority and sets the outlines in 1984. I actually think in the very long run, at some point, something like that is inevitable with the internet. We have a new technology, much like cable was, that disrupts everything, and that doesn't fit into the old buckets of broadcast and telecom. And I think we're seeing the same thing now. So in many ways, I think the worst thing that could possibly happen is us not rewriting the internet. What's the rewriting the communications laws? Now, what's the problem with writing the communications laws? Any major rewrite takes time. The Cable Act took, 14 years? The Copyright Act took 14 years. The Cable Act took an extended amount of time. And I proceed from a premise, which is that all of the major it's easier to stop legislation than it is to push it forward. And that, in fact, any of the major industry players, if they don't like legislation, can probably stop it in their tracks. And the way you get major legislative reform is you create a situation where the status quo is worse for every major player than actually doing something. And so I think the next mode of analysis will be is what pressures does the existing legal regime put on the different players? Is there something else that they would be willing to bargain away certain positions to get a push forward? And in my opinion, those bargains take a certain amount of time, and that, in fact, we may need a teleprompter-like moment which reshuffles the financial interests. But I do think that something like that's inevitable. It's just a question of finding the right alliance of technological, political, and economic forces where all of a sudden becomes enough in the interests of enough of the players that the balance shifts. The only potential one I see on the horizon right now is if the D.C. Circuit does say the federal government has no jurisdiction, and that instead of simply remanding the order, they also vacate it.
Okay, let's get back to that. Corey?
Like Chris, I don't hate the title either, but I think it begs the question, why do you want to rewrite it? I think that that's a critical question. I think that the role for Congress to play if it were to undertake a rewrite is to really examine where you think there are problems in particular markets, not reflexively apply regulations that were crafted for a different time and a different technology and apply it sort of wholesale to the internet. That said, I do think that there are incredibly important principles that were established in the Telecom Act that tried to eject some competition into markets that typically have very high barriers to entry and a lot of potential for anti-competitive leverage of physical infrastructure. And a lot of those values, I think, are what made the internet into the robust place that it is, where there's lots of competition, but as long as that you can guarantee that there is competition on the access to the internet, that we can guarantee that there will be the innovative marketplace for ideas that we've come to expect. Heralding to what Professor Yu said in reference to the D.C. Circuit, there are some concerns that the ability of the federal government to step in and preserve what we expect the internet to look like in terms of this venue for competition may be challenged. I'm not going to presume the outcome of that litigation right now, but I certainly think it's a contingency that may affect the conversation about whether we need to revisit and clarify the FCC's authority to protect the innovative model.
So I don't hate the title either.
Yes.
we get the question all the time from reporters, and so it needs to be answered. So it's just fine. My answer to the question, though, is no, not now. I agree with the professor that perhaps eventually it's inevitable. But right now, there is absolutely no consensus about where you would even begin amending the act. We have the debt and the deficit, and we have immigration, and we're just beginning to get to a place on those issues where there's consensus that something needs to be done. Okay, we don't have that with respect to communications law. And in fact, I'd like to go into a little bit of history because it's really relevant and going back all the way to the 1970s when I was still in school. But the 70s and the 80s, the FCC had a series of cases called the Computer Inquiry. And they had this Computer 2 framework that they established that separated the transport function, which was regulated, from the data processing function, which was unregulated and became known later as information services. So the whole engine behind, the whole reason why Congress got going on the Telecom Act of 96 was that the Bell companies that were broken up from AT&T in the Reagan Justice Department's plan to create competition for the first time in telecommunications services, the Bells wanted freedom from the antitrust line of business restrictions that kept them out of both information services and manufacturing and long distance, which at that point was really lucrative and becoming competitive. So Congress said, okay, we'll get you out from under Judge Green and we'll give you to the FCC, but only if you accept mandatory interconnection requirements to facilitate competition in your local phone markets, and so that we could actually have the possibility of local phone competition, not just long distance, and rates coming down and all the things that go with competition. So the champions included House Energy and Commerce Chairman Tom Bliley, Senators Trent Lott and Larry Pressler, along with Senator Hollings, and the only one who's still there, Ed Markey. Once the Bells got what they wanted in terms of relief from the antitrust restrictions, they convinced the FCC and the courts to pretty much give short shrift to the unbundling and interconnection requirements. They convinced the FCC that broadband internet access was not transport, but rather should be deregulated information services. And then in the business side, reconsolidation started happening like crazy, reconstituting Ma Bell into what some are now calling the Ma-Cell hybrid, wireline and wireless duopoly. Cue Stephen Colbert's map of the United States where they're putting it all back together. And the result is everything has come full circle. So now The big telephone companies are saying, never mind that FCC stuff. We want antitrust to be the only relevant standard. So, and that's where we are.
So, I agree with my co-panelists. I mean, in some ways, really, to simplify, the 96 Act was about taking away regulation of the phone system from Judge Green, didn't want it anyway, had been doing it for some number of years as a result of the consent decree in the antitrust case, and that was a good thing. I think the sort of in its principal purpose, the Telecom Act has been a failure in the sense of injecting competition. Obviously, the CLECs came, the CLECs went. As sort of a creation of competition really didn't generate much of value. What actually, so I started thinking about this, and what I wrote to Tim was I said, should the simple answer to the question, should the Telecom Act be written? I said, yes. And in some ways, now I'm going to say no, because through a happy coincidence of the fact that the commercial internet was in very much in its infancy at the time of the 96 Act, it really wasn't taken into too much consideration in the drafting of the bill. That's the happy coincidence that has given us the internet environment, the internet ecosystem, the broadband environment that we have now, is the happy accident of the fact that Congress didn't really give it much consideration in the drafting of the 96 Act. And you can look at whichever statistics you prefer about availability and use and adoption and jobs and productivity and any other thing you want to say, but I think generally speaking, it's hard to argue with the idea that the development of the internet since 96 has been a resounding success on pretty much any dimension you want. It's not a coincidence, I think, that that's because the 96 Act really doesn't give the FCC much authority over it, and the FCC has not exercised very much authority over it. And to the extent that that we have competition, to the extent that we have success here, it's really a function of the advances in the technology more than anything else. It's not, it's not because of a brilliant regulatory structure. We have now in the ecosystem, we have a very complex set of market dynamics that really introduce discipline, obviously not perfectly, no system ever does, but much more successfully, I think, than any sort of detailed regulation would have. Where, particularly, let's say in the mobile, well, actually, all along you have wireline being disciplined by wireless. Increasingly, we have the intermodal competition in broadband within the mobile space. The manufacturers of the phone, the operating system developers, Android and iOS, the app developers, the consumers. In some ways, they're the ones who are disciplining the market from the infrastructure standpoint. Much better, again, not perfect, but much better than I think we would if the FCC was treating it the way they would continue to treat wireline telephone, which it's no surprise, is a dying business. I don't think it's a coincidence that it's a dying business. It's partly a dying business because the helpful hand of regulation has made it unable to really respond to a market that is very dynamic and is very dynamic because of technology. Because the technology isn't going to get any less dynamic in the next 10 years, in some sense, we're probably best off doing nothing, leaving the FCC largely or almost exclusively out of the picture, and letting the ecosystem continue to evolve in the weird, strange trajectory that it does, and interfering or interceding only when something really is truly broken. We can sort of measure how badly it's broken, and then we can come up with a regulatory or a legislative solution that doesn't make it more broken in the process.
So you reminded me, I was trying to think of all the reasons why the other panel hated my title, and you reminded me of what that was. And one of the panelists said, this panel should have been titled, instead of Did the Internet Kill the Telecom Act, should have been titled, Was the Telecom Act written so poorly and so obsolete that it didn't kill the Internet? And the idea was that had Congress given more thought to the Internet, they might have killed the Internet. That was the other person's complaint. But let me go to a little exercise really quickly.
Sure.
Just on the because we can be pundits, like we'll pretend we're on like CNN or something and say, will this Congress pass legislation in this Congress or at least in the next six Congresses? And again, you know, as Kathy pointed out, I mean, this stuff started happening, you know, grumpy old Judge Green not wanting to, like, regulate the nation's telecommunications infrastructure, and something had to be done. So that process started, like, 6 years out to when it actually was enacted. And I don't know if the turnover in the Congress in 1984 had any impact on that extra 2 years. I don't know. But 6 years at least, right? So let's just imagine, like, 6 years out, that's like halfway through the next whoever the next president is. We just had an inauguration yesterday, but 2 years out, like, in the second year of the next president's term, maybe we might get something. What are the chances? Like, why? What are the imperatives? What are the imperatives that two people have pointed out that it could be a decision this summer, perhaps, on the net neutrality, open internet rules could force something. But longer, going further out, what do you think the practicalities of? Look and try to be, you know, try to think, you know, free, you know, big sky. What could happen where you'd say, huh? And there's a couple of ways to do this, right? You could say, well, let's have a new Title VII, put everybody in it, everybody has the same rules. An IP, you know, maybe the FCC and their technology transition task force might think of something like that. Or you could have kind of like a incremental approach, like we did with VoIP. It was voice service, but it was going over IP. And there was a regulatory proceeding that kind of said that it's not really a telecommunications service and it might be an information service, but whatever. Like, let's apply E911 and universal service to it. And we're not going to get too specific about what kind of a service it is and whether it's an internet service or a non-information or whatever. Or you could look at the example of, like, closed captioning for broadcast, right? It's closed captioning, the broadcast regulation that closed captioning shall be done on broadcast television, which I think is a very good thing since I got my career started on disabilities access issues. But Congress, in the last Congress in October, passed rules they went into effect requiring internet video. I forget exactly how it's defined to have closed captioning. And they even defined what user-generated content on the internet was so that it would not be applied to that, which was, an elegant definition, if I may. So, practically speaking, look down the road. What do you think might be imperatives that we might say, well, it's better than an incremental approach or a patchwork approach, or we have these classifications, we're going to get on this road of just like trying to make these kind of strange definitional discussions. Maybe we should just do it all in one fell swoop.
I can see one major driver that may get the Senate certainly to act, which is the wireline telephone network is in the process of dying. And in fact, I think much to the FCC's credit, the chairman of the National Broadband Plan has launched a dialogue of when we're going to shut down the old public switch telephone network. Because maintaining two networks that are largely redundant is extremely expensive. Frankly, copper, people are stealing it out of buildings now. There's a recycle value to it that's useful to society. But with the death of the telephone network as we know it today goes the Universal Service Fund and all the mandates that go with it. And there's a huge political constituency that when they see that in jeopardy, there'll be, I think, some impetus to try to change things. Now, I don't want I really dislike knee-jerk extension of old regimes to new regimes. You know, I saw this with 911 and wireless. People said, well, in the old wireless pre-GPS, you couldn't get location data out of that, which you could get out of the old public switch telephone network for free because they didn't move. And my reaction was, the cell phone is the most brilliant emergency device created. And if you happen to lose something that you got for free in the old telephone network and you make them retrofit it on a new one, that's a really stupid move. Because you're not leveraging the new advantages made possible by the new technology and you're hypnotized by the old technology. I don't think it's an accident that Google is not doing voice in Kansas City. Because in a new VoIP-based world, the regulatory apparatus that we've developed around telephony is so onerous, they simply just think it's not worth doing.
You can do voice over any IP.
Right. And the interesting question is there'll be a knee-jerk reaction to take... VoIP has some of the mandates that we moved over from Title II. And there will be some people who will want to pull all of the existing Title II regime in a world that's technologically different, competitively different, and I think creates substantial new opportunities. I'll give you one last example. In the 1996 Act, when they said you got released from regulation when you faced real competition, they said, is wireless real competition? They said, oh, no, in the first round. This is obvious. I mean, my students don't have landline phones anymore. And this is the idea that they're not competing to me was a technological old-world blinders. And they actually backed up when PCS came on and said, okay, well, PCS is different. Well, it's not. It was just a graceful way for them to get out of what was really
a mess. I saw that Kathy wanted to jump in there.
Reality check here. Reality check. Okay. When the violent storm happened this summer, you couldn't use any phone, wireless or otherwise, to get to 911 in Virginia. That's because of the deterioration of the public switch telephone network. Okay, so public safety, that's important, right? Congress would agree on public safety. In fact, they passed legislation last year involving spectrum for a public safety first responders network. We don't have it yet, okay? So this rush to kind of transition to IP and retire the old phone voice that nobody ever uses anymore, it's a little overblown, okay? Because things like 911 are still important. Things like grandma, at the farm, whose only connection with the rest of the world is her voice line, is important. But it goes even way beyond that, okay? Because as Christopher pointed out, people are talking about wires, period, being dead. Well, that is ridiculous, okay? Fiber is so much more, has so much more capacity than you're ever going to have in the city in a mobile wireless situation. That it's really, really valuable. That's why Google did that thing in Kansas City, because they knew that there would be a market for wired to businesses and to anchor institutions and to even individual residences. There would be a market for 1 gig. And indeed, there is a market for 1 gig. So getting back to Tim's question, what would I see legislation looking like? Well, first of all, my experience tells me that even though I taught a graduate course in, telecom policy, and my father was a college president, and you can have wonderful academic discussions, that's not how Congress operates. So the first question is, what would the impetus be for legislation 5 years from now, 6 years from now? What I would predict is that one of the possible triggers for legislation down the road would be too many residents, households, small businesses in the U.S., be they rural, be they inner city, whatever, can't get internet access for a reasonable price. As Congresswoman Eshoo mentioned this morning, there are 100 million people that don't have internet access now. And there are 19 million who, even if they had the digital literacy and the money, they still couldn't get it.
I'll point out before I get to solicit comments from Corey or for Larry. I will note that we don't have a lot. I'm glad you mentioned rural, because the three co-chairs of the Congressional Internet Caucus, and historically most of them, have been from very rural districts. So it's a very important issue. And even in the big broadband panel we have later, we don't really have a rural representative, so to speak, from those issues. Very important. But Corey, Larry.
I guess I just would offer a point of clarification, which shed some light, I think, on this issue of what are the impetuses to potentially regulating the internet. I think that the potential transition to IP-based delivery raises a lot of issues about whether things need to be updated or tweaked. But I would add that the fact that Comcast is abandoning QAM and AT&T is abandoning TDM to switch to IP-delivered is not the same thing as an internet-delivered service. So, it's kind of like the broadcast television transition. You had the broadcasters switch to digital delivered television, but they did not cease to be broadcasters. By virtue of the change in their technology, we did not have new broadcasters enter the market and add to competition. And so even though a new technology is being employed, I'm not sure that some of the core concerns that we may have about interconnection, about 911, about public safety, necessarily fall away because we're employing a new form of technology. Those questions may need to be addressed if there is an IP transition, but that's fundamentally different than saying we need to apply regulation to the internet, where I think a lot of people would point out that it's actually a very competitive market. If you look at, for example, what my company does is we deliver video, and if you go online, you can do Netflix, you can do Amazon, you can do Apple, you can do HBO Go. But if I look to providers that are offering Netflix-type services but are in the more traditional space, I see two competitors who control facilities. And I think that's a really important distinction to make. So you may be able to get video from a Comcast on-demand app, or you might be able to find something similar from your telco provider. But they're not delivering via the open internet, and the competitive pressures that they feel are not the same that internet-delivered video or similar services face. So when we look at what are the impetuses or impeti for
triggers,
thank you, for revisiting, we have to look at where there's potential market failure, where there's potential for abuse and leverage of power, and not reflexively apply regulations to a market that don't need it, but also make sure that just because we're magically switching to some other delivery form, we're not ignoring real potential for market abuse that has sort of been built into the network.
So as I said at the outset, I think it's not potential market failure that we should legislate. It's actual market failure. And again, only if we have a solution that doesn't make it worse. I don't understand the political process at all. So what will actually take place or what will drive it, I can't guess. I think probably, though, the one thing we haven't mentioned yet that could drive an emergency or the sense of emergency that requires legislation is hitting the spectrum wall. When we had the introduction of the iPhone in 2007, any prediction about mobile broadband usage went out the window. And as a result, the 2010 National Broadband Plan said if these numbers continue, or God forbid they get worse, we would need 300 megahertz more spectrum by 2012 and 500 megahertz by 2015. We're working towards, in lots of different ways towards getting that spectrum, and then the secondary markets are helping to alleviate some of the crunch again. But if there's another iPhone that gets introduced without anybody really having it in their prediction models sometime in the near future, those estimates or those efforts could prove to be insufficient. And it's possible that we would hit a true spectrum wall where the networks just can't handle the capacity of new devices. That, I think, is the kind of emergency that could drive legislative changes.
That's really interesting that all your responses, I've asked a lot of people in canvassing this, putting this panel together, what are the realities of having a rewriting the Telecom Act, and a lot of people have been like, okay, do the whip count. How many votes does the Senate need to, how many seats do the Republicans need to take over in the Senate, and like all these different machinations about like the political realities of how to get legislation passed. I think appropriately this panel identified a lot of different drivers of what could happen. Professor, you started off with the open internet order. Like, what would happen depending on how the courts come down this summer? It might be this summer, right?
Almost certainly will be this summer.
This summer, how it comes down, that might be a driver. Someone mentioned universal service, big deal. All of a sudden, you don't have people in the rural states not having that subsidy and maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, depending on your political position. That's fine. We have public safety issues that are drivers. We have an aging PSTN that's not going to be cared for, perhaps. We have rural disenfranchisement. There's also issues related to kind of peering, perhaps. People, can these different networks peer with each other and interconnect, as Corey kind of pointed out, in ways that are not disruptive to the consumer experience or when I want to watch my football game online, things like that. And then, Larry identified spectrum. I think one of the things that I'd like you to, since you raised it, we don't want to go into each one of those and debate them, but because I want to go next to kind of questions from the audience. We do have to talk, I think, about what would happen this summer depending on how the court comes down on the open internet order. And would that drive and have a kind of become an impetus for congressional or even more regulatory, maybe not regulatory action, but congressional action? What would happen if the courts come down and say, they could say, FCC, you really didn't go that far beyond your jurisdiction, just a wee bit, we're going to come down this way. Or they'll say, you almost did, but not quite, we're going to uphold it. Or they say, the Telecom Act didn't give you this jurisdiction at all, you are way beyond the bounds of your regulatory authority, like way beyond. And then, how does that affect things that you guys have identified, whether it be universal service, rural, peering, interconnection, the ability of the FCC to do some of the things that maybe we want them to do? and that you guys have identified as drivers. So does try to imagine how the open internet order decision, depending on how it comes down, could affect the other drivers that you're talking about, thus impetizing congressional action.
We should just stay away from the word impetus.
It's horrible.
I mean, the only thing I would point out is, regardless, and I'm sort of not placing judgment on this one way or the other, regardless how the court comes down, the FCC could reclassify broadband access service into Title II, and then it would have the authority to do what it tried to do this time under ancillary jurisdiction. Now, that is generally considered to be fairly politically unpalatable, but I just wanted to flag that there is an option that is short of statutory intervention from Congress should the FCC decide to take it. Anyone's guess is as good as mine about whether that's really the case. But there are a number of iterations of the court's decision. And if the assumption is that Title II is off the table and the court says, well, hey, FCC, we're not really sure that you have the ability to do it, then I do think that that is an unacceptable circumstance to tell the American people that everything that they have come to love about the internet and what they want to continue is taken out of the realm of the protective function of the government, and that we cannot guarantee that it will be open. The internet itself is, a tremendous driver for innovation, but it doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot if you can't get there in the first place. And there's not as much competition, or the extent there is competition, is quite fragile for access in the broadband market. The vast majority of Americans have a choice between two providers if they're lucky. I think that there's a lot of hope that wireless could inject more competition. It's not here yet, and who knows when it will get here. So I do think that to the extent that the FCC does not have other options to protect consumers, should the open internet rules take a dive, then that could certainly force a situation, but it's really hard to predict how that will happen.
It is hard to predict, and I apologize for putting you on the spot there, but if the open internet rules go down hard, then happens.
So go ahead.
Well, I agree that the commission took an unprecedented number of volume of comments on the broadband industry practices docket that led to the open internet rule. They spent a lot of time crafting a Title II light framework. So in other words, common carrier regulation but without rate regulation. Not telephone rate regulation at all, but rather a light touch way to have to clarify some jurisdiction over broadband internet access. And it's important for two reasons. It's not only that most Americans have come to rely on the openness of their internet connection and that their internet access provider, be they a cable company or a telephone company, is not going to be a gatekeeper to the content of what they want to get to or the applications they want to use. It's not only that. It's the right to an internet connection in the first place. Okay, so the universal service that we knew of in terms of telephone service in the 20th century, it was basically telling the American public, you have a right to a phone connection, even if it costs the companies a lot of money to provide it. We'll have subsidies, but whatever, but you have a right. So as Corey rightly points out, depending on what the commission's decision says, if it actually says, no, FCC, you have no jurisdiction over broadband internet access at all, then you will have members of Congress saying, well, when my constituents come to me and they say that their internet connection went out and nobody will fix it, or the rates went so high they can't afford them and they have nobody to switch to, what will I tell them? And the FCC will say, can't help you. We have no jurisdiction. Of course, the other extreme is to say broadband internet access is a civil right. It's a human right. I'm not here to say that. But, I do think that we need something similar to the Telecom Act for broadband internet access in the future.
So I see a different scenario. And first, just to correct something Corey said, the open internet order is not based on ancillary jurisdiction. That was what they tried in the Comcast case and lost. The open internet order is based on direct jurisdiction under Section 706. That's what the D.C. Circuit is going to look like. And I will also disagree with Chris. I don't think it's coming this summer because I think the D.C. Circuit's likely to wait until the Supreme Court rules on the City of Arlington case to decide how much deference to give to the FCC on its interpretation of Section 706. That case was just argued last week. But I think the more likely scenario is, let's say that the D.C. Circuit does rule that Section 706, which was kind of the last remaining provision the FCC hadn't really had a chance to try out in the Comcast case, doesn't work to support the open Internet order. I don't think it's the case that that means, American citizens are without any protection. In fact, the likely scenario then is that a sort of enforcement of the broadband marketplace shifts from the FCC to the Federal Trade Commission. And the Federal Trade Commission, which is becoming increasingly active in Internet-related activities and has already rattled the saber quite a bit about broadband in general, they will then, I think, take over sort of disciplining the market using traditional adjudicative procedures and using an antitrust standard. Again, is there actual harm? Is it demonstrable? Is there a remedy? And what's the crafting of that remedy? The other alternative, obviously, is legislation from Congress, either to change Section 706 to make it explicit authority or to somehow otherwise give the FCC more specific authority. Obviously, a lot of those bills were introduced after the Comcast case was decided. None of them moved. I don't even think any of them moved out of committee. And I think it would be hard-pressed to think that there would be a specific kind of net neutrality bill that would run after this if that happened. So I think, as I say, the more likely scenario is kind of enforcement of the broadband industry's ecosystem's behavior would shift to the Federal Trade Commission and it would move to an antitrust-based regime.
So the networks are not just some other service. The networks are critical infrastructure, and the FTC has no jurisdiction over the critical infrastructure that is that are broadband networks. They don't.
Well, I want to take a slightly different tack. So one thing is, if the order is struck down, it is really in the FCC's court about whether they're going to do the Title II move. And if they try to reclassify as Title II, we've learned something from the recent World Conference International Telecommunications, held by the International Telecommunications Unit. And what we discover is the ETNO proposal to fold the Internet back into basically traditional telecom regulation is one of the few things that's actually unified every part of the Internet industry. You know, content providers don't want it, network providers don't want it. It's actually because it's going to make it extremely politicized. And I think that, in fact, if that is a choice the FCC will have to make, there are people I know that believe that the determination to do Title II was a reflection of the current leadership of the FCC. If rumors are to be believed, the FCC's leadership is quite likely to change sometime early in this administration, and it'll be unclear how that goes. The other thing I'd like to put on the table is what happens if the order is sustained. And what's interesting is I've actually done, as part of a contract for the German government, they've actually retained me to say, so can you tell us how these early network neutrality enforcement actions have gone? And what's fascinating to me is, well, the easy one is the first one brought was the Metro PCS one, which still hasn't budged since January of 2011, going on 2 years. But more to the point, some of the ones that are brewing really get some really tough questions. So Google Wallet, does this apply to near-field communications, which is not even Internet? Does it apply to chip design, AT&T FaceTime? Does voice compete with video chat? Does it apply to operating systems? And in fact, there's a whole bunch of issues that are going to be extremely contentious if we get there. One last chestnut I'll throw on the table, which is, one of the things we're talking around is, I think it's great, Catherine actually, and Corey and I, when I say universal service and she says rural, we're in the 19 million, we're saying the same thing, which is that really is a thorny problem that is not going to go away. I mean, any regime, that's a very serious issue. I do think that the story that's happening in wireless outside the rurals is a pretty happy one, because right now, LTE, I saw a Computer World article where they did surveys, it delivers on order 8 to 12 megabits, which is above benchmark rates. Verizon's right now got 89% of their country, 470 cities, projected to finish deployment nation. Their whole network is 98% of the United States by year-end 2013. Right now, AT&T's got 150 cities, also projected essentially to fill up the network by the end of 2013. Sprint's coming fast with a lot of money from SoftBank. They're at 49 cities. They're desperately trying to claw their way in. And if we end up with a world where we get three wireless players by the end of calendar year 2013 providing 8 to 12 megabits of service to a substantial part of the country, That's a very, very, not the rurals. I mean, we got a problem there. But that's a very interesting world.
Let me jump in. I'm glad Kathy, in her opening, mentioned antitrust, and we kind of went back on that as well. And we can get back to that, but I don't want to take up too much time. I will point out that your statement about the telecom space being a very happy one, the panel that we did right before did the Internet Kill the Telecom Act in 2005 was titled 100 Megabits by 2010, Forecast or Fantasy? And that was what they were saying. We need, you know, the administration and other people were saying we need 100 megabits by 2010. I don't think we're there, right?
No.
And that would have been 2010. It would have been 2015. So that was like 3 years ago. We would have had to reach that benchmark, and a lot has happened in 3 years. I will also note that this panel, like this afternoon session, is features GigU, speakers from GigU, and also from Google Fiber Kansas City. So probably we should have switched them, had that panel first, so we could have asked them some of these questions. What idiot put together this conference? Like, who put the order together for this? But one thing that's interesting is that I think what will happen in that conversation is people say, well, you know, that's great that Google can come into Kansas City and get these, you know, and you mentioned they're not offering voice, I guess. I'm sure there's a reason why you said
nobody
that.
Nobody needs to offer voice anymore because you can do voice over any IP.
But I think there's a reason.
Why would you?
But if the question is how, if Universal Service Fund runs away, and how much of the existing telecom framework that's governing landline voice are we going to extend to VoIP? Because there's going to be a political impetus to do exactly
right.
That.
And I think there's a point for Professor Yu to say that. And the Google, you know, maybe we'll discuss later in this panel, and is that it'd be great if everybody was as unregulated as, you know, if you could go into a market like that and replicate that among all the different providers and not have to do as many franchise issues. And remember the franchise discussions when Fios and Uverse were going into the different municipalities. But, you know, there's always this question of, like, regulatory parity. Like, I'd like to be as unregulated as that person. And then,
well, there's a really good current example of that. Yeah. So I think it's 23 states have passed deregulation of local phone service already, and 19 have actually been convinced by the big cable and telephone providers to prohibit municipal broadband, not only access, but prohibit municipal broadband operations because they see it as competition. And so, you know, that doesn't apply to AirU and GigU, thankfully. You know, but the whole point is that the barriers to competition, the barriers to entry are such that, you know, oh, well, Google did Kansas City. Kansas City is one city. It
Absolutely.
Took them 3 years. It took them ridiculous. I mean, they even, the competitors who are already there in that market are very jealous of the fact that they got to cut some corners in terms of pole attachments and this and that and the other. Well, if Google can only do one market in 3 years, what other company is going to provide competition?
Well, let's leave that. That's the point for the next panel. I just wanted to raise that because I inappropriately timed these panels to lay, like, put the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm the least knowledgeable person in this entire room, and I've spoken the most. Can I get some questions from folks?
Just a quick clarification for a relative newbie. But you're talking about the Verizon case, which some people call a net neutrality.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
It's easy.
That was easy.
Like those questions.
I love this part.
Yeah.
Or the open internet.
It's Verizon and Metro PCS
yes.
together suing the FCC over
but,
the open internet.
But it looks like the lead plaintiff, based on what they thought, it's going to be captured in Verizon versus the FCC.
But you're saying that you didn't think that was going to turn down until summer?
Well,
I think it's later.
They set the argument
later,
for January? I'm trying to remember.
No, they've not set the argument.
They haven't set the argument.
I think it will be by summer because there was another case before the D.C. Circuit that raised some of the questions. Yeah, on data roaming that raised some of the questions about the City of Arlington case, and they didn't decide to wait on deciding that one. So I think looking at some time later this spring, early summer is...
But no one tells Article III judges what to do.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
D.C. Circuit, sometimes it's 6 years in some of their decisions from, but unlikely here, but... It could happen.
I'm Gary Harlan from Arlington Communications. One of your speakers tomorrow has often said that the question is not about regarding your title is not should it be rewritten, but who will rewrite it? Is it going to be Comcast and AT&T and Verizon or some other parties, Google or whomever? And what are your thoughts about who might rewrite it? And if anybody, now you're second-guessing Congress, not just the court, if anybody up there 4, 6, 8 years from now can really think beyond a telecom act that is based on railroad regulation and radio regulation. I've got another question, but let's start with one at a time.
So I don't even know if it's who's going to rewrite it as so much as when is it actually rewritten, even when we think it's rewritten. I was working in, when the 96 Act came out, I was working in Germany for a startup telephone company, and they were astonished when the 96 Act passed. You know, wow, you just deregulated your phone system. You know, even as a startup in Germany, we wouldn't even ask for that because we can't imagine we would ever get something so. And I thought, oh yes, we're so, look at us, you know, we're so proud of everything. Well, then it turns out, in fact, the actual writing of the Telecom Act didn't really start until after it was passed, and we started the, you know, years and years of litigation and and rulemaking and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not actually sure when the 96 Act was passed. We're still having some cases that are just looking at definitions, so we're still on Title, you know, one of the Act. So even if we did rewrite the Telecom Act, when it actually, you know, gets rewritten is not as clear as I thought it was.
Well, the answer, part of the answer is that if the big cable companies and telephone companies did not write the act, then they wouldn't like it, so they could stop it. So there you go. Nobody mentioned a really good model in the Western world, and that's in the UK, where the regulators actually decided to force a structural solution on BT and have the local distribution network be spun off, and it's called OpenReach, and then all, not only BT, but all other internet access providers get access on equal terms and conditions to that local distribution to serve their end users. And guess what? BT was dragged kicking and screaming, but it works, and now they're happy, and the users are happy because the users have choices of dozens and dozens of internet access providers. And it could be. I'm not familiar with Australia. It could be. I'm sure someone in the room knows.
I was just in England. Users are not happy.
They
can't get internet.
There's something really strange happening in Australia, which is the government has nationalized the backbone. And so, that's a whole conversation in of itself, which I think we don't want to get into. I guess an answer to your question is who's going to rewrite it? All of the above. Catherine's absolutely right. If the major cable industry and telephone industry players don't like the act, they probably can throw enough sand in the gears to stop it. The same can be said for the major content players, who've been extremely influential in these debates in the last 10 years. And the interesting model for me is how the network neutrality logjam was broken, which was the Verizon-Google agreement about conceding non-discrimination in turn for a lower standard on wireless, where Verizon was interested, their revenue growth, their profits growth, they're all coming out of wireless. And they see that. And so they were willing to sacrifice something in their wireline business, even though they just invested $24 billion in fiber, in order to get something else they wanted. And then Google got something that they were concerned about, which was a non-discrimination rule. And to me, this is how these kinds of deals get cut. Now, what strikes me, though, is I do think that it is an interesting contrast to Europe. It is a foregone conclusion, almost, that the internet will be regulated like the telephone network in Europe. They have no fiber. If you look at their numbers, the investment numbers in Europe are terrible because they still face unbundling of all their broadband properties, so they have to sell that at wholesale, which in the ratchet up because you update for modern technology is below what they paid for in cost. They have no prospect of using video as a driver for financing it because right now they do that on levies on television. A lot of satellite is free. And that, in fact, many of the existing broadcasters are state-owned, and so they're actually going to fight like crazy. And they don't have a bargaining position to actually do it through interconnection agreements. And actually, if you talk to my friends at Ofcom, when I talk to them about the UK regulator, actually, Ofcom's not actually that happy with how functional separation is turning out under that regime.
They do have competition, though.
They have service-based competition, but they have no actual investment in infrastructure. It's resale of the existing DSL line, and they're not getting upgrades to fiber, and they're actually not getting upgrades to wireless.
Well, Garland has a question over here to the left.
No, I just was going to find the urgency on what building fiber right now. Ofcom not even building fiber.
Ofcom's the regulator. It's not government owned.
The only one building fiber right now is
BT.
Is Virgin.
Virgin.
Okay. Let me. Let me.
So, and, but anyway, okay. So Virgin is because that was the other, it's a disaster. The problem with Australia was Salter Deal, and that was failing to get.
International comparisons are really hard out of context.
But the thing I was going to keep coming back to that I don't get is everybody talks about the competition, the fact that they have a lot more, you have a lot more competition over Europe, but it's all on one pipe, which is the problem they've got into right now. They talk about, I've got 15 different ISPs, I choose from. Yeah, but you're all terminating on one pipe, which is just. When they got ultra high def coming in, it's forget it. It's just, but you're actually, that's why Luigi with Telecom Italia heading up Etno did that absolutely outrageous thing with Wicked. So,
wow.
We have only one pipe here. That's where we're headed. It's telephone for business. It's telephone for business, and it's cable for.
In any of these towns,
Garland, let me just say, I only have like one, I have only a few. Garland.
If you go to any municipality, and you sit down when they go in to get their franchise.
This is turning into a long story, Garland.
Verizon has to do to get their fire. They don't want their people to have choice because what they want to do is hold up Verizon or anybody else that comes in. And they say, well, we have to have a bronze statue of the mayor. And we have to have outfits for
Garland,
the police officers.
Every city is different.
I would have liked to have the.
Because they have to do the, you know, shake them down.
If there was a question wrapped up in that, I don't know. But I think I have one more. And I would beg you if you could use the microphone, I can hand it to you.
So, Garland's soliloquy wasn't captured on audio.
And for that webcast audience at home.
Just continuing the same debate in terms of competition and the access towards internet. As in, you mentioned that there's just one in the. Chairman Jen Nikoski just came out with an op-ed that said 80% of internet users have at least access to two cable internet providers. And also, as in, even if there's no competition, is that really a bad thing in terms of what Jeff Eisenach talks about with dynamic competition, where all the metrics that you check or you look at, the U.S. is coming to the top, as in half the 4G providers, 4G users are in the U.S., amongst the entire world population. Well, and so even if there's no competition or little competition in terms of access to broadband, does that really affect the industry in terms of all the metrics that are coming out?
Yes. Yes. And,
it does.
Go ahead.
As you say, the point about 4G adoption, that's certainly that's heartening. But when you're looking at wireline providers, it's two, maybe, and that competition is fragile. I can say
diminishing,
yes. Working for a company that gets our content to people via a subscription to a broadband access provider, the fact that that competition is in problematic states in a lot of areas is of concern for us because there's an awful lot of leverage if all of our customers can only see us and they have very few choices in the sort of ramps to the internet. I agree, the internet itself is really dynamic and very innovative, but unfortunately the paths to get there are restricted. Our broadband prices, I think, compared to the rest of the world are disheartening. The speeds compared to the rest of the world are disheartening. And all of that can have a really constrictive impact on innovation on the internet itself because the pathways there are unfortunately not as competitive as they should be.
I guess I have a different perspective, and I pull the FCC data. And the last data we have is from June 2011. Now, Grant, this is very early in the LTE deployment, which started December 2010. And so this understates radically. And so what do I see? Under the historical measures, which we have, the only thing we have time series back to 1995 is an old standard, 200 kilobits per second in one direction. There are now more wireless subscribers than DSL and cable modem combined. And that is growing at 300%. Cable's growing at 11%. So, I mean, and if you go to the 3 meg right now, it's not the 3 meg standard which they're tracking. It's not as attractive. But as of June 2011, the growth rates are very, very similar. And what you start to see is they have the opportunity to deliver on average 8 to 12 measured speeds in the wild up to 50. And what you start to see is they say that even under that standard, if you include wireless, 89.3% of Americans have access to three broadband services. And so a lot of it depends on how you think about whether broadband is an effective competitor. And the interesting question is, in the old 3G world, I think that was a much a much easier question. What we start to see is if it really is delivering 8 to 12, and no one seems to be buying more than 8 to 12, and even on the wireline side, the fixed line side, the suggestion is that it could really be effective. Now, there are some urban problems, which we're solving with the Wi-Fi. There are some rural problems. I mean, I don't mean to say that there aren't their share of things we have to work on, but there is the foundation for a really robust deployment of LTE, multi-provider deployment of LTE, which I think, frankly, bodes really well for the U.S. internet ecosystem compared to the rest of the world.
Which is a good story on wireless, but on the wireline side, DSL is one of the things they want to retire. I mean, copper DSL is copper, and that's what they want to retire.
I wish we had a more time to talk about the antitrust discussion that we had. Many years in Europe, they do have lower thresholds for antitrust. Actually, they seem to be pretty low to me, just as my observation. And you know, Chairman Goodlatte, who now took over the Judiciary Committee, has been talking for years and years and years about why are we doing all this regulatory stuff in the Commerce Committee when it really should be in Judiciary Committee in antitrust. And I think we can do that. So you may see something from the new chairman on that. But a quick last question from Mr. Zimmerman.
Sure, I'll try to wrap my speech into a question. I just have to disagree on the state of wireline competition. I mean, sure, copper DSL may be going away, but that's being replaced by, you know, fiber, or they're pushing fiber further into the network. But AT&T and Verizon are not simply abandoning wireline. We haven't talked about CenturyLink that doesn't have a wireless play at all. They are not going to simply fold up shop and go away. They're going to invest more, and I know it's sort of the, you know, bash America crowd with respect to speeds, which are, you know, we heard, Tim asked, you know, did we get to 100 megabit by 2010? Well, no, we didn't, but 50% of America today has access to 100 megabit, 80% has access to 50 megabits or better. I don't believe that Verizon, AT&T, and others are simply going to abandon wireline altogether. They're not. No, Verizon has sold off some rural properties, but they're still investing in Fios. They're still investing in fiber. They might be pulling out copper. They're putting in fiber instead. And I'm not here to shill for the phone companies, but I think it's wrong to say that wireline competition is going away. And also, we talked about innovation. Right. Well, I guess the question is, how can we spur innovation? But I think it's important to note, as we talk about other countries and how fantastic it is over there, that virtually every meaningful innovation, every application that I use, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, Reddit, you know, half the things that I don't even know about, all originated here in the U.S. So I think the internet ecosystem and the infrastructure ecosystem is pretty damn good.
Depending where you are.
So to answer Tim's question, one thing that has been overlooked is that, can we get 100 megabits? And I would say that basically with the advent of DOCSIS 3.0, the cable industry can now pair bond an unlimited number of channels. And basically that 100 megabits is available through the coaxial plant now. I mean, that's fairly clear. But they haven't provisioned the backhaul. They're not going to, because there's simply, frankly, not the demand. There's not uptake of these higher end services.
I have friends and family in northeastern states who were promised Fios who are never going to get it now. The company says
because
you're
cable,
not going to get it.
I mean, fiber has been fiber to the home.
Gone. You have Fairpoint there and other companies.
But they're not getting fiber at all.
But what's fascinating is fiber to the home is not paid out in any of the jurisdictions it's been tried in. The most mature deployment and the nationwide deployment in Japan is widely regarded as a disaster. A disaster by the shareholders. It's regarded as a success by the Japanese government, who owns, what, a third of NTT stock. And so, I mean, they're the controlling shareholder. And so the idea that a student asked me, aren't the people who aren't doing fiber being incredibly short-sighted? And I said, it all depends on how fast the revenue comes. So what's the first thing that happened when Verizon announced Fios? Cut their stock price in half. Cut their bond rating. Raise their cost of capital. Essentially, they borrowed the money, started paying interest on it from day one. And now it's a race. How fast does the revenue come in, and is this a good deal? And so far, Verizon's been just baking its thresholds by just barely. They can tell an acceptable story. But I notice in their press releases, they're not talking about Fios anymore. They're talking about LTE.
Well, let me. We have almost no time left. And I think the conversations about what our speeds are, in what areas, by when. By the way, I didn't ask that
I asked the question back in 2005 with a panel, and the panel answered it, whether it was forecast or fantasy. And today, I guess it'd be part of a longer conversation to answer that question today from a reality perspective and parsing the data. We can have debates about that. I think when it was interesting to talk about different channels and different speeds and all that on that, I think the interesting thing about the panel coming up this afternoon on big broadband is, you know, talking about, you know, certain wireline broadband and with very, very high speeds, whether it be DOCSIS, whether it be GigU, whether it be Google Fiber, and to talk about some of those issues in that context might be illustrative of this conversation. I'm well over time. I thank you all. And I do note, the panel is always very collegial. I do note that almost all of these microphones is like dents in the microphone. I can only assume that was because like fights break out and people hit each other over the head with the Shure microphone. Yeah. So I want to thank the panel for not doing that. Right now, actually about 2 minutes ago, lunch started to be served downstairs in the ballroom. We have Congressman Chairman Goodlatte speaking with the CEO of Uber. So thanks to the panel.